Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everyone. Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us online for the first time. Welcome back to everyone else. I want to talk tonight about creating a positive change in the world and some Buddhist reflections on how fucked up the world is and what are we going to do about it. Is there anything we can do about it? I like to start class by asking you to talk to each other in service of one of the core Buddhist principles is developing community. And the only way that we develop community is communicating with each other and talking to each other and meeting each other. And it can be common in my experience in a lot of Buddhist groups where you go and you meditate and you listen to a talk and you leave and you never really connect. You never really meet each other until long-term attendance. So I like to have an icebreaker where you kind of awkwardly communicate with each other and meet some people in the room. And so the topic for tonight at home, I put you in these Zoom breakout rooms and about three quarters of you join. I encourage all of you to join. Think of it as a meditation practice, as a Buddhist practice of listening and talking and just being uncomfortable if that makes you uncomfortable, or excited if you're, you know, sort of the extroverts and the introverts. Buddhism can attract a lot of introverts because they're like, cool, I want to do something where people will fucking leave me alone and meditate and nobody's going to talk to me. I like that. But then, you know, and the extroverts can be like, cool, finally I get to talk instead of just listening and reflecting. So anyway, small groups, and the topic is, what are you doing about it? At the end of, you know, when we offer merit at the end of every session, I say something like, together may we create a positive change on this planet. And thinking for a moment about what it is that you are doing or trying to do or wanting to do, aspire to do, that feels like it's creating a positive change on the planet. And that can be as simple as becoming a kinder person is a positive thing for the world. Your own transformation. And of course, Buddhism mostly focuses on our own transformation, becoming kinder, wiser, more loving, more forgiving, more compassionate. It's the core teachings of Buddhism is personal awakening, transformation, liberation. But how does that wisdom that you're developing and wise intentions that you have or are developing feel like it's helping? And not just you, but the people that have to deal with you. When I say the planet, I don't have to mean the whole world, but all of the people in our lives are the world, all the people that have to interact with us. And, you know, so that's friends and family and work and driving down the street and, you know, walking into the store. And the world is all of the things that we interact with. Maybe including the environment, the planet itself. And so what is it that you're doing about it, about this situation of that we're in, of the world? How are you trying to make a positive change? That's a small topic for your small groups. So find two or three people that you don't know and talk to them about how you're trying to make a positive change in the world. I think probably the core message that the Buddha had for us and that I'll be sharing tonight is about personal transformation as the most altruistic thing we could do for the planet. ending our own confusion, our own ignorance, our own suffering. And that comes from wisdom that is developed through meditation. We can't think or study or believe our way into wisdom. It's something that has to come from meditative insight. Wisdom is something that we can experience, not something that we can just learn about or believe in. And meditation is the path, is the tool, is the main technology, technique to develop wisdom from a Buddhist perspective. So this is a meditation group so that we can practice and not just discuss wisdom, but develop it together. So finding a way to sit that's upright, that's relaxed, that's meditative, establishing a sitting posture that feels sustainable. Settling into relative stillness. Taking a moment to allow your eyes to be gently closed and your body to be relaxed around the upright skeleton. Releasing all of the unnecessary tension in the face and jaw, neck and shoulders, chest and belly. Let the flesh of your body hang loosely around the skeleton. And try to allow the body to breathe all by itself. Establishing mindfulness, present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness. Awareness that receives rather than controls. Awareness that knows what's happening rather than manipulates our experience. Non-judgmental, kind awareness of the experience of sitting with the eyes closed, with the body relaxed. This body breathes all by itself, the heart beats. No need to control it, just observe, receive, bring awareness. Make a strong aspiration to be kind to your experience, to be friendly, to be accepting, to be tolerant, even when the body becomes uncomfortable or anxious, even if the mind is loud, annoying. Be kind to your mind, be friendly, be accepting. Be as tolerant as you can be. This is meditation. Kind awareness. using the sensations that the breath creates as the focus in the beginning is useful. Disconnecting from being involved in what the mind is thinking about, directing the attention to the breath. Let the thoughts be in the background. Keep coming back to the breath, perhaps noting in and out with each breath, or just receiving the sensations. The Buddha said something like, breathing in, one knows I'm breathing in. What allows you to know whether the breath is coming or going? Awareness, receiving, tracking, comprehending, the constantly changing and permanent nature of the breath. So you can continue to use the breath as a anchor to the present moment, present time experience. The practice of mindfulness expands, becomes more inclusive. The breath teaches us how to concentrate and to ignore the mind. This is the first insight, the first relief we get from this kind of meditation. But for the practice to be truly transformative, we have to begin to investigate the whole body, the sense doors, the emotions, the thoughts, including the mind, the sounds. Spending some time investigating the impermanent reality of all of the phenomena that arises in the heart, the mind, the body, how it's changing, rising, sustaining, passing. Just as each breath comes and goes, each emotion rises and falls, each thought passes through awareness, proliferates, dissolves. And we perceive our experiences as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Get curious. Are the thoughts that are coming through your mind pleasant thoughts or unpleasant? Craving, aversion, judgment, fear. What's the feeling tone? Is your body comfortable or uncomfortable, pleasant or unpleasant? Is your heart light or heavy, pleasant or unpleasant? Bringing awareness to the feeling tone and the impermanent nature of whatever's happening brings awareness to the cause of suffering, the clinging for pleasure, craving, resistance, aversion, anger about pain. This is where we begin to learn to let go, to accept our experience just as it is, to tolerate the pain, to try to be kind, compassionate to those painful thoughts, feelings, and sensations. without changing your posture, or reflect on what's the kindest thing I can do? What's the kindest response I can muster in this moment towards my body? Softening the belly, relaxing into what's happening, even if it's uncomfortable. What's the kindest relationship I can have to this mind that compares and judges and feels anxious? taking this intention to be kind and friendly and accepting towards ourselves and beginning to extend it to the people sitting next to you, just as I wish to be at ease in my own being, my own skin, heart, mind. May you be at ease. May you do what needs to be done to experience the freedom you seek, the wisdom. Extending this loving kindness, attitude, metta, goodwill to everyone here in the Sangha, gathered in the room, gathered across the world on Zoom and all their different places joining us. Sending loving kindness to each other. May you be at ease. May you be successful in finding freedom, finding happiness, developing wisdom. And extending this outward in all directions until we include all loving beings with a heart of kindness and compassion. Encouragement, may all beings do what needs to be done. May all beings successfully heal the wounds, the confusion, the ignorance. As I said in the beginning, my sense is that the Buddha's core message was one of empowerment and teaching, guiding, inspiring, supporting transformation, pointing out that it's possible to end suffering in one's life through one's own effort in this lifetime. Without any kind of divine intervention. Buddhism is a humanist psychology, believing in the human ability and potential through our own efforts to transform, to awaken, to develop wisdom. There's no grace, there's no blessings, there's no interventions from magical beings, just the human ability to train one's own mind through meditation and renunciation, and to become more and more awake and to see more clearly and to respond more wisely through our own efforts in this lifetime. It's a core message of the Four Noble Truths, of the Eightfold Path, of all of the early Buddhist teachings. I say early Buddhist teachings because I wanted to reflect a little bit on some of the later Buddhist teachings after the Buddha lived about 2,600 years ago and then lived for about 80 years, had about 40 years of enlightened existence, about half of his life, teaching as an awakened being, as he's kind of figured it out in his late 30s, and then spent the rest of his life teaching other people how to figure it out, mindfulness, non-attachment, compassion, love, forgiveness, generosity, and always said, like, this isn't a theory, this is my direct experience of how I no longer suffer about the mind and body, the internal experience, or about the world. And he lived in a world of great ignorance. It was not a peaceful culture that he was in. It wasn't an ideal, it was a world of war. It was a world of racism. It was a world of sexism. It was a world of violence. The caste system and, deep systematic racist oppression, systematic gender oppression, homophobia, though, kind of just basically like the world we live in, but the ancient version of human ignorance, 2,600 years ago, no cell phones, no technology, just people oppressing each other organically, no online bullying. And a core part, I think last week I talked about the ethics and meditation, sila, samadhi, panya, and I talked about, the three things that we have to develop, and such a core part of the Buddhist teachings is compassion. If you want to end suffering in your own life, compassion isn't an option. It's not optional, it's a necessity. Compassion is the only wise relationship to anything unpleasant, everything unpleasant. If we meet anything unpleasant with anything other than compassion, we're making it worse. We're creating suffering for ourselves. And it's a setup because we're not born into a compassionate heart and mind and body. We're born into a heart, mind, body that is aversive to pain, not friendly and caring and compassionate towards it. So much of the task is compassion. So much of what we have to meditate and uncover and connect with and train, and I say it in the instructions, it starts with tolerance. Compassion starts with learning to be uncomfortable, learning to be in pain. I think sometimes we think of compassion as like, if I'm compassionate, it won't hurt. That's really, actually, the bad news is compassion does not take away pain. Compassion is the wise response to pain. It's a bit soothing to pain. The absence of compassion, the tension, the resistance, the aversion, the judgment, the anger, the fear that we usually meet, painful, internal or external, makes it worse. So in that way, when you're compassionate, there's some relief to it, but it doesn't get rid of the core unpleasant sensation, emotion, thought, sound, smell, taste. Compassion does not get rid of pain. It just helps us deal with it. What are you going to do about it? I'm going to try to be compassionate towards it. I'm going to try to be friendly towards it. I'm going to try to be accepting and tolerant, merciful. I mean, you've heard this, mercy and compassion as part of the continuum of this skill we're trying to develop, this wise response. Mercy, by definition, is not making it worse. If you look up, it says something like, not causing harm in a situation where you have the power to cause harm is merciful. It's not even that nice. It's not even that loving or friendly. Like, mercy isn't like that caring. It's just like, I could kick your ass and I'm not going to. I have mercy on you. I could totally hurt you in so many ways. And I'm not going to, because I have mercy. I'm going to refrain from hurting you. And taking that internal, like, once you start practicing mindfulness, you start waking up to like, oh, everything's impermanent. And it's my clinging that creates suffering. I'm clinging to impermanent, or there's all of these unpleasant things, and my resistance to it makes it worse. Every time I cling, every time I resist, I judge, I fear, I hate, I resent, I'm making my life worse. I'm creating more suffering for myself and probably the people around me. I become less and less pleasant to be around, and often we spill our pain and our resistance and our craving and our judgment and fear onto the people around us. So not only are we creating suffering for ourselves, we're also annoying our friends. So the act of mercy is, so every time we're let go, it's an act of mercy. Every time we tolerate the pain rather than resist it, it's an act of mercy. Not making it worse. Resistance kicks your own ass. Judgment and resentment and hatred creates suffering for ourselves. We're kicking our own asses every day. We're making it worse. And with meditative skill, with practice, we have the ability to stop making it worse, to be merciful. Stop hurting yourself. Stop making it worse. Easy to say, not so easy to do. It's a long-term, gradual skill transformation that has to happen in our lives through meditation, through renunciation, through generosity and service and getting out of our self-centered, fear-based habitual tendencies and into new attitudes and actions. And so I say all of this, some explanation of my perspective on the task and compassion and the central teaching in early Buddhism of compassion being, you know, there's, I think last week I said there's three necessary skills. If you want to be happy, if you want to be free, if you want to create a positive change on this planet, only three things you got to do. Only three. I mean, there's probably more, but we simplify it into these three categories. And it's compassion and non-attachment and non-identification, not being self-centered. But so tonight, kind of focusing a little bit more on compassion. But also, non-attachment is an act of compassion. It's an act of mercy. Not clinging is a compassionate thing to do for yourself and others. So the Buddha put all of this emphasis on develop compassion. And it's, sometimes I say develop, but in many of the teachings, it's more like uncover. That the nervous system, the biological evolutionary of the human body has a tendency towards aversion to pain. It's your survival instinct. It's not your fault. We're all born with it. Hating pain is normal. Compassion is actually somewhat abnormal. It's actually pretty radical to truly have mercy and compassion and tolerance for pain. It's a developed or uncover. So, and the, but in many places, the Buddha says, when I saw clearly through the cause of suffering, the experience of suffering, and I, the wisdom of mindfulness led to this wisdom, where the heart radiated compassion all by itself. And so, it's this perspective that underneath the habitual, reactive, aversive tendency of the survival instinct, I know that's a lot of words, habitual reaction, the habit of reacting with aversion to pain. Underneath that, there is part of our being, our awareness, our consciousness that is compassionate. The citta is one of the ways that the Buddha talked about the heart, mind, the awareness. Some of my teachers talk about citta as loving awareness. There's the term bodhicitta, wise loving awareness. And bodhicitta then connected to what in later forms of Buddhism, in what we call the northern school of Buddhism. I don't know if you know this, but Buddhism was in India. Northern India, and then as Buddhism spread, first it spread south. It went to Sri Lanka and over to Burma and Thailand. But there's the Silk Road that went through, northern India and from, probably Europe and through, Greece and Iran and Afghanistan and across India and over into China. And it kind of went right through what they call the trade routes. And so Buddhism started to spread along the Silk Road. And for some reason, one form, the kind of old school form, mostly what we call the Theravada, mostly went south. The Silk Road kind of splits Asia in half. And to the south of that is Thailand and Burma and Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Sri Lanka. And mostly they became the kind of the elder school, the Theravadins. And then later, a few hundred years after the Buddha, as Buddhism was spreading, a new form, the new school, they called themselves Mahayana. And it mostly went north for whatever reason. The Mahayana mostly, as Buddhism went to China and Korea and Japan, and then later to Tibet, Nepal. And in the Mahayana, which, about 700 years after, 700 to 1,000 years after the Buddha's life, became more and more popular as Buddhism really spread to northern Asia. And one of the core differences from the Mahayana and the Theravada, the southern and northern school, is that they started to focus on compassion, not just internally, but bodhicitta, bodhisattva became a term of taking a compassionate vow to alleviate suffering for all living beings. And it became a little bit less about your personal liberation through your own efforts and a little bit more into compassionate service for others. And even there's these vows, these bodhisattva vows that got developed. Some of you are probably pretty familiar with them, and they're different in the Tibetan Mahayana Vajrayana traditions or in the Korean Zen or Japanese Zen, but there's a kind of similarity where it's basically saying, because I want to be compassionate, I'm going to take a vow to not attain liberation until I help all other beings attain liberation. I'm going to keep coming back rather than getting enlightened, and the kind of definition of enlightenment in Buddhism is no more rebirth, not coming back to this realm, being entering the deathless, entering a state of non-returning. And so, the Bodhisattva said, "Well, because we're trying to," the Mahayana said, "because we're trying to be compassionate, it's kind of it sounds almost a little selfish to just like go get enlightened. So let's make a vow to postpone our enlightenment till we help everyone else. And I'm gonna kind of put your happiness before mine out of compassion." And kind of right. And when I say it like that, it sounds a little codependent, a little like everybody else gets to be happy but me. What can I do to caretake everyone else? But the core of it is, yes, maybe there's some codependency in there, but really, it's a very, what a beautiful Wow, what a beautiful thing to care so much. Like, I'm going to help. I want to come back as many times as I need to be of service, to be generous, to be kind, to be loving, to be inspiring. I care about all living beings, and I'm going to postpone my liberation. In one of the Zen forms of the Bodhisattva vow that I'm familiar with, they say something like, beings are numberless. I vow to liberate them all. And I like the acknowledgement that it's not possible in the vow itself. It's numberless. And I'm gonna, there's no end. I vow to liberate it, them all, even though there's no end. The next part of it says, suffering is endless. I vow to end it all. And I almost feel like there's a sense of humor in it, almost kind of this sort of like, I know it's not possible, but I'm gonna try. Out of compassion, I'm gonna try. I know I can't save all living beings, but I'm gonna live my life and in a way that I'm gonna try to do what I can for as many beings as I can. And including not just in this lifetime, but I'll keep coming back. I'm committed to coming back as many times as I need to help others and to get out of the self-centered, where's my happiness? And wake up to actually, we are interconnected, and how can I help you? And the more I help you, actually, the more it frees me from my self-cherishing, self-centered, self-clinging. It's that wisdom that they knew in the 12-step, in the Alcoholics Anonymous, that early recovery where they're like, if you're suffering from alcoholism, go help someone else. It will help you. Get out of your self-centered fear. It will help you alleviate your own cravings by being of service to someone else. And so there is absolute benefits to being of service. We all know that. And I feel it's part of what the Bodhisattva intention, aspiration is. Can be a little bit confusing if you're new to Buddhism and you're like, okay, what the? The Theravada, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana. There's some similarities and some differences in the different schools of Buddhism. Having been in a position for a long time where people will be like, I read your book, I'm inspired to practice Buddhism, and now I'm going to this place, and I'll be like, oh, fuck, not them. Wrong tradition. That one's not good. I'll give you, there's a long list. In my own early kind of exploration, I was like, okay, well, the Dalai Lama seems really fucking cool. Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, let's look into that and read his books and go, try to get some teachings. And I think in mid-90s, I was in India and I got to do, I don't know, it was a 7 or a 10 day empowerment at Bodh Gaya with the Dalai Lama. And it was the whole thing was on the Bodhisattva vow and this whole several days of committing to never getting enlightened. And it was a bit, I was like, fuck, am I, should I want to get enlightened? And but I also want to be compassionate. I want to create a positive change in this world. But these guys are really convinced that the best thing you can do is be of service to others and postpone your enlightenment and not take liberation. And then I have these other Theravadan Thai forest tradition people in my ear saying, like, actually, the best thing you can do is get free. The most altruistic thing you can do is be an example of liberation. That's what the Buddha did, the OG, be like him. And, you know, so I can remember being a bit like, okay, where do I, do I want to be a Bodhisattva? Do I want to be a Theravada? Do I want to be a, where do I land? And I did these teachings and I was with some friends and took the vows, I'm fucked. I don't ever get to get enlightened now. I have to keep coming back over and over until the numberless beings are liberated. Just after the vows, we took a train, overnight train, and showed up in Delhi, you know, a day later in the middle of the night. And we're going into some hostel. And then one of the guys, we're traveling with this Australian guy with long, you know, dreadlocks, long kind of white dude with dreadlocks. And he'd been traveling around India for quite some time. And his name was Stu. He was great, really, you know, good connection with him. But the hostel we were going into would let me and these other couple of Americans that I was with, but they wouldn't let him into the hostel. And they said that he was a bad Baba. Baba is like the kind of Hindu sadhus. And they were like, yeah, we don't. And it was this total, like, not racist, but I guess racist, but it was just oppressive of just, like, we don't let people with dreadlocks into our hostel, sorry. And I got violent real quick. And I had just taken the Bodhisattva vow to liberate all beings, and I was within like minutes of showing up. I was like, I'll fucking bash your head in if you don't let my friend in here. Fuck all living beings, you fucking fascist. All living beings except for fascists can live. Eventually, they let him in. Yes. There was a little bit of vandalism. In early in Theravadan Buddhism, the term Bodhisattva is used. The Buddha refers to himself. He says, when I was still just a lowly, unenlightened bodhisattva. So in the northern school, bodhisattva is the goal. It's this big sort of high, you know, kind of one of the highest vows you can take is to be so compassionate that you'll help all living beings. But the original meaning of the term bodhi being wisdom or awakened, and sattva being of the seeking awakening. And so the Buddha said, you know, when I was still seeking enlightenment, before I found it, when I was a lowly, unenlightened bodhisattva seeking enlightenment and didn't have the connotation of postponing, it was like, that is my, I want to get there. I'm committed to getting there. I'm going to do everything that I can to develop as much wisdom as I can to free myself from suffering, not just from my own experience, but because I really believe that will be beneficial to all living beings. The more of us can get free, the less suffering there is on the planet. The more we inspire others, we show it's possible. You don't have to stay stuck in greed and hatred and delusion. You can free yourself from greed, hatred, and delusion. That example, I mean, here we are, 2,600 years later, still talking about Siddhartha Gautama because he became kind and compassionate and non-attached and wise. And that example of is so inspiring. And here we are, you know, fucking other side of the planet, thousands of years later, still talking about the guy. I was like, it was amazing. There was this kind person. 2,600 years ago, there was somebody who was non-attached and loving and compassionate and wise. And we're like, oh, fuck, I want that. What do I got to do? Okay, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Five Precepts, Meditation, Renunciation. I'm in. I want to be kind. I want to be wise. I want to be free. I want to aspire. And whether it's for the benefit of all living beings and returning endlessly, or it's just like, I want to live this life to the best of my ability to create a positive change in myself, in my family, in my community, in my, on the planet. The kind of, think globally, act locally, from the inside out. There's so much overt ignorance happening in our country politically right now. And I say overt because there's always a bunch of ignorance happening in our country and every country and all the time. But sometimes they're a little bit better at hiding it.
Yeah.
And deluding the masses into, you know, there's nothing going on over here. And right now it's just like blatant, overt. We are ignorant, greedy, confused beings, and we don't give a fuck if you see us that way, because that's, you know, it's actually more honest. There's this weird thing that's happening where, like, they're just like, we're douchebags. We are racist, sexist, homophobic douchebags, and proud of it, rather than hiding behind
a white sheet
or whatever else, you know, hiding behind other, you know, things. So to create a positive change on the planet, I'd be curious. I wish I could have been in all of the small groups to hear what people were saying, that they're, how they're trying to do it. And where's the, for me, I'm always, have been for a long time wrestling with, where's the line between acceptance and complacency? Where's the line between non-attachment and irresponsibility? And I don't have the answers, but I think that they're important questions for us to ask ourselves. What's the difference between equanimity and being at ease with the way things are, and being complicit and not working for a positive change? And there can be some danger in some of the Buddhist practices that we do that can lead to a sense of equanimity and acceptance, and that can be lead to inaction. And I know I spent so long being so angry and working, you know, in my own self-destructive ways to rebel, that I got a little afraid of that energy, and a little kind of like, oh, I need to be careful with my anger at injustice. And I want to have compassion for it, but, you know, when I get too worked up, I see how quickly I can get into threatening the innkeeper after the Bodhisattva's vow. And I don't want to do that. I want to be calm. I want to be kind. I want to be compassionate. I want to be loving. And that sometimes it looks and feels and honestly is a bit of complacency about creating a positive change and actually confronting the racist person. Or the system of oppression that we're, you know, living in, that I get a little afraid of my own anger about it and my own ways that I'll create suffering or maybe create harm. And I have identified in myself that my Buddhist practice has led to a pretty good ability to be non-attached. But I've also seen how some of that non-attachment has been irresponsible, not as responsive, and I don't always have as wise of a response as I'd like to. But I get a little detached rather than engaged with loving. And even the term compassion, it has passion right in it. that there's some, it's like a, you know, that it's okay to be passionate about creating positive change, that it's okay to be passionate. I think that sometimes my own, I don't know about you, but that I got a little, I've seen, you know, a tendency to be a bit afraid of the passion, because I was passionate about a lot of things that created a lot of suffering in my life for a long time. And so then I wanted to become chill. And that passion can like quickly turn into unskillful behavior. And so finding that balance. Had a from Against the Stream, I like when I'm giving this talk, I like to share my soapbox. A couple of pages that I wrote here about the Revolutionary Manifesto about defying the lies of the world. It says, "We've all been seduced by the world's enchanting offers of happiness through pleasure and accumulation. But they are lies, shams, fallacies. In order to find the true happiness and freedom that are available, we must understand this clearly. We must experience a revolution in our perception of the material world. Inside each one of us resides the truth, and however deeply buried or obscured that truth has become, we have the ability to uncover and experience it for ourselves, and happiness and freedom will follow. The path to liberation is one of defiance and renunciation. We must overthrow the deluded dictators of our minds and see through the confusion of the world. This will take great effort and a steadfast engagement with our own moment-to-moment experience. Every day we are being lied to by the world. Our societies, our families, and our religions tend to be filled with delusional ideals. Human beings have created a deeply dysfunctional culture. The insecurity of the human condition has led to the creation of many violent religions and scientific rationalizations. We have been destroying each other and this planet for too long. Human ignorance is the status quo. Even in the most highly educated or religious people, we see the unnecessary suffering of ego identification, lack of acceptance, and greed for power. In America, we like to talk about equality and human rights, but this country was founded on violence and oppression. Our forefathers stole this land from the native peoples, waging war on the rightful inhabitants of the continent. The history of slavery and racist oppression towards each newly arriving ethnicity on these shores has left us with a legacy of ignorance. Although some of the outright bigotry has lessened in our recent past, racism is still the substratum of our society's structure. This is not just an American phenomenon, of course. In fact, our classist, sexist, and racist culture is quite similar to the ancient India society that the Buddha was born into. Ignorance is not just Western or Eastern, it's human. For the awakened revolution to take root, the pervasive racist structure of society has to be dismantled. This is what the Buddha began to do way back in the day through nonviolent defiance and compassionate engagement with the systems of oppression. There is nothing incompatible between defying the lies of human ignorance and serving the truth of enlightened human potential. Defiance is renunciation. The effort to avoid and speak out against the causes of suffering is always going to be part of the path of spiritual awakening. Religion, which was obviously created to give meaning and purpose to people, has become part of the oppression. This is true in both Eastern and Western religious traditions. The Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad were all revolutionaries who critiqued and attempted to dismantle the corrupt societal traditions of their time. Yet their teachings, like most things in human societies, have been distorted and co-opted by the confused and power-hungry patriarchal traditions. What were once the creation myths of ancient cultures have become doctrines of oppression. More blood has been spilled and more people oppressed in the name of religion than any other reason in history. Although faith and religiosity are central to human history, it may be time to reject all forms of organized religion and to begin afresh with a practical, applicable, experiential philosophy. I would reject so-called Buddhism along with the rest. Because much of what masquerades as Buddhism, that long list, is in a direct opposition to what the Buddha actually did and taught. The Buddha was insistent on questioning and defying the religious structure. He urged everyone he came into contact with to find the truth for themselves, not based on faith or tradition, but of their own direct experience of wisdom and compassion. So the spiritual revolutionary must defy the religious structures as well as the material world. We can look to religious and spiritual teachings for the tools of awakening. The truth does reside in most of the religions, but we must understand that all religions also contain confused traditions and lies that need to be destroyed by clear understanding and our own direct experience of awakening. Defiance means standing up for what you know is right, rejecting patriarchal human dogma, and embracing the search for meaning with a steadfast engagement with reality. It means seeing clearly our mind's fears and attachments as impersonal conditioned phenomena and destroying the misidentification with the mind's confusion. Beneath the confusion, we will find the heart's natural wisdom and compassion. The spiritual revolutionary defies both the internal and external forces of oppression. Yeah. Few minutes for questions, comments, clarifications, anything you'd like to discuss. John, go ahead.
I'm really happy to hear talking about Mahayana stuff. I found just so much insight and I guess utility in the Bodhisattva precepts, and reminded me kind of a teaching I heard from a gentleman that mostly teaches sutras, but the focused on kind of like historical context of Buddhism, and like specifically sort of the evolution from the Hinayana sort of Theravadan, and it wasn't really until kind of apparently a couple hundred years later that Mahayana kind of evolved. It was in the context of like cities, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about
universities that.
And just kind of sort of like these situations. To me, it just seemed like it almost felt like, I don't know, like it had a weird parallel almost to like America, where it was like, oh, we're very individualistic, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's attainment through self-action and everything. And then, you know, like the Mahayana version is more like, well, we're all kind of like, we come up together, essentially, right? We're like, we all kind of have to work cooperatively. And like, just thinking about that now, it's kind of like, yeah, like that American, like individualism, it's not like working out so well, because you're starting to realize like this interdependence, not just within this country, right? With our neighbors and like within the world. And so it feels like it's maybe just kind of like a natural evolution in a way of like this interdependence on each other. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even just kind of like I mean, I haven't seen like kind of like reflections of it throughout other spiritual traditions, like mm-hmm. you're in church for Easter, you know, and it's like I was thinking about like Jesus, you know, he's like, yeah, he's out there speaking about social injustice, mm-hmm. you know, like very sort of like, you know, like center stage, like very visible, right? He's making people upset. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, but it was just kind of like, yeah, it's love, you know, it's like focusing on the low hanging fruit, right? Like the poor and like the people that don't have, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like that's exactly kind of like what the problem is right now in this country, is there's just so many people that are on that bottom rung. It's like, it's kind of like one one person like that's pointing to for his power and wisdom, and it's just like, it seems like time for a shift, you know, like more sort of holistic, just kind of a reflection on like the evolution of that of like Buddhism, because like I myself have just found a lot of I don't know, a lot of wisdom in Mahayana, and I don't really know that much about Mahayana, but it seems insightful too.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I've been, you know, I refer to Against the Stream as an American tradition. Because I can't quite be 100% Theravadan because I'm so influenced by some of the Mahayana and Vajrayana teachings. And, you know, it is that sort of, you know, America as the melting pot of cultures. And, you know, like you kind of, I've never been able to be like, well, it's, I mostly lean towards Thai forest tradition and some of the Burmese traditions. As far as the meditation techniques, I like them the best and some of the teachings. But then the Bodhisattva, the focus on interdependence and compassionate action and engagement in community, not such the sort of renunciation off into the forest, but staying engaged in being of service in the world, really, really inspires me. And so I feel like, you know, kind of what we're doing here is cherry picking, you know, some of the best of the different traditions from my perspective anyways, and in incorporating them all, like in Refuge, putting the Tonglen, which is a Mahayana meditation, into this kind of mostly Theravadan-based tradition, because there's really good teachings in all of the traditions. And, you know, and as I said in that, I think I was a little bit more open-minded when I wrote that than I am now. You know, but like, you know, as I was reading that passage and it said, you know, the truth does reside in all of the world's religions. I'm not so sure if that's true or not. But there is a universal human truth that's beyond religion. And that's not about Buddhism, and it's about wisdom, it's about kindness, and it's that humanist psychology that we can all uncover. If you pay attention, it's awareness leads to wisdom. Did you wanna? Yeah, go ahead.
Just a basic thing of,
Yeah.
is there any places around here that do engage Buddhist, like, outreach or ways to spread these kind of, like, actually live out the love of the
Yeah.
people? I find that the Christians really,
They're good at
they got
it.
a lock on, like,
Yeah.
every single, like, outreach and stuff, and again, great people are getting helped,
Yeah.
but it is sometimes hard to be like, oh yeah, I'm
Sure.
compassion, compassion, compassion. Oh, I am just one person. It is usually more effective with like a group of people to do any sort of outreach.
There have been a bunch of communities that have tried it. The Buddhist Peace Fellowship is the kind of main one that's like an engaged Buddhist outreach that came out of the Thich Nhat Hanh school, but is sort of multi-denominational. They're more Bay Area and East Coast, but they do have some stuff in, you know, that happens, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. You know, George, before in class during the small groups, asked if, because here at Against the Stream, we used to be a much larger organization, and we had a bunch of employees, and we had, you know, with several meditation centers around the country, and we were a bit more organized on that level for, and we used to organize groups to go to the protests, and we were out doing, you know, feeding the homeless, and we had more in, you know, socially engaged things that we're doing when we were a larger organization. And as I've been rebuilding the organization after that sort of crumbled a few years ago, I haven't gotten to the place yet where I feel like, you know, me and Sebastian are just like kind of trying to keep the lights on. And we haven't had a lot of energy to actually kind of facilitate that kind of community. I know that John and I have talked about it. So my sense is like there's so many good organizations. It doesn't have to be a Buddhist organization to get involved with environmental work or social work or homeless work or you know, whatever it is that you know, want to, political activism. It doesn't have to be around your Buddhist community, just as, you know, kind of go undercover and do that work in the world. That having been said, George did ask me to save some time because maybe we are at a place and a time where it's feeling more urgent that our community does organize, and George wanted to say something about that, and I support it and will support him. So say whatever you want to say about it.
Just piggybacking on what you said, I've been involved with the community almost 15 years, and we had a lot of people, and we had a lot of energy, and we would do beach cleanups and protests and feeding the homeless and sock drives. Like, we were a lot more active, I felt like.
We had a full-time volunteer coordinator that would like get all of this going, and So now it's up to you guys to coordinate it, and George is gonna.
There's a lot going on in the world.
Yeah.
A lot of people are unhappy, and I think in the next, you know, months and years, there's gonna be a lot more need for this type of action. We used to call it getting off the cushion, you know, taking the breakfast outside of the rooms and bringing it out to the world. And so I was just gonna try to put together a list tonight if you wanna come talk to me after. Probably not email, nobody does email, probably like a WhatsApp group, I think that works well. Come talk to me after, you know, it doesn't have to be one thing or another, but it just, let's get busy, let's get active, let's make change. Come talk to me.
Yeah. 100% support of that, and I don't know if those of you at home can, if you want to be on this against the stream, engaged, off the cushion, action committee. You can put your number in the chat and George can add you to that even if you're not local. These are probably gonna be local things in Los Angeles that we'll be doing, but maybe there'll be ways for people from other places to also participate in some way or another, so. I think we'll leave it there for tonight, since we're just about out of time. I've got one, maybe two, but let's just say one first come, first serve spot left for the retreat in Joshua Tree. It was sold out. We ended up getting a few more rooms, and I think there's one or maybe two spots left for registration. If you want to come, you better do it now. Register now. And if you have registered and you don't think you're going to make it, let us know, because there is a waiting list and we want to make sure that we're going to get everybody in there that wants to be. And that's May 13th through 18th, 5-day silent retreat out in Joshua Tree. And Sri Lanka Against the Stream Adventure is November 10th through 24th. And it's happening. People are registered. I've bought my tickets. We're going to Sri Lanka in November, and it's going to be some silent retreat time, some beach time, some adventure in ancient temples. We're going to go see the end of it is at the Bodhi tree, which is the oldest kind of living sapling tree of the tree that the Buddha was enlightened under. And Sri Lanka is the most ancient Buddhist culture on the planet, because Buddhism died in India. In India, there's Buddhist tourism, but there's very little Buddhism being practiced in India. And even the Buddhism that is being practiced there is like the, you know, refugees, Tibetan refugees. So there is a bunch of Tibetans there. But in the Indian culture, Buddhism died for the most part. It's like 1% of India practices Buddhism, less than 1%. But in Sri Lanka, ever since the time of the Buddha, it's an unbroken lineage of people practicing the Theravadan tradition. So it should be a very special trip, and you're all invited if you have a few thousand dollars to spend and 2 weeks off of work to travel to the other side of the planet and hang out with us. If you can afford it, you're welcome to come. I have a day long here this coming Sunday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., sitting meditation, walking meditation. You're all invited. We're doing registration for that through Refuge Recovery, because I'm doing it as a Zoom for the Refuge Recovery community, but it's one of the times where I mix the Against the Stream Refuge, and even though it's I'm calling it Refuge, it's just going to be a straight up mindfulness day of meditation and sitting and walking. And there's a $50 registration fee if you can afford it, but also there's a free scholarship available to anybody who asks for it. So you can sign up for that on refugerecovery.org, and you can choose to pay $50 if you can afford it, or you can choose to pay $100 if you can afford to like sponsor someone else, or you can choose to pay nothing. It's up to you. So it's freely offered. Everybody's welcome to come. There's also a new Refuge Recovery t-shirt that we have. That's the logo, and then it says Wisdom and Compassion. And I think that's available on the Refuge Recovery site, and it's available here. So you can check those out. All good ways to support us. And lastly, Support is necessary for running a meditation center and supporting a teacher. So be as generous as you can be. Class is done by donation. Suggested donation, $25. If you can afford that, please give it. If you can afford more, please give more. If you can't afford that, give whatever is appropriate to you. Give 5 or 10 or whatever feels generous to, based on your means and your current ability to share some of your resources. So thank you in advance for your donations. And may any goodness that comes from our meditation and contemplation, reflection, be shared outward in all directions with all living beings. May each one of us get as free as possible in this lifetime. And may we create a positive change from the inside out for the benefit of all living beings. Thanks, everybody. Good to see you. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.